And the fifth case for this morning is number 074028, Rupi versus Mukasey.
Good morning, Your Honor. Michael Piston appearing upon behalf of the respondent. There are several questions here. I think the first one that we have to deal with is whether this is an appeal from a decision of a Board of Immigration Appeals denying Mr. Rupi his application for asylum. He's a Baptist from Russia who the court accepted as credible his testimony that he was brutally beaten at least twice by Ukrainian nationalists, and he was threatened with death as a result of which he left the Ukraine. The immigration judge held and the Board of Immigration Court agreed that Mr. Rupi had not been persecuted. We feel that that finding is directly contrary to a couple of this court's decisions. Mr. Rupi was beaten, very severely beaten. He was beaten a number of times by these nationalists, but he was most severely beaten in 1996 and again in 2000. In the 1996 attack, he suffered a hematoma of the eye, among other things. In the 2000 attack, he suffered a concussion. He was hospitalized for 2 days as a result of the 1996 attack, as a result of 13 days as a result of the 2000 attack. And what is equally significant is that his house was broken into. He was left a death threat, and which basically was a picture of a person in a coffin and said, if you continue doing what you're doing, which is basically proselytizing his Baptist beliefs, this is what's going to happen to you.
What is the evidence in the record about the connection between these incidents and the government?
The connection with the government is that the Ukrainian nationalists is a group which the government cannot or will not control. And the evidence of that is the fact that Mr. Rupi testified that he made repeated complaints to the police and they failed to take any action whatsoever to pursue this matter. There are a number of cases holding that police inaction is evidence that the government does not have that the group is one that the government cannot control. We find that the best one is actually one issued by the Board of Immigration Appeals, which unfortunately I only discovered yesterday and submitted to the court under Rule 28J. It's the matter of OZ and IZ, 22 INN Decision 23. And in many ways, it's almost a clone of Mr. Rupi's case. It was a Jewish person from the Ukraine who was repeatedly beaten by Ukrainian nationalists who were anti-Semitic. And the board stated that the respondent reported at least three of these incidents to the police, who took no action beyond writing a report. Therefore, it concluded that it appears the Ukrainian government was unable or unwilling to control the respondent's attackers and protect him or his son from anti-Semitic acts of violence. In fact, Mr. Rupi's son also has been attacked, but that's really not central to this case. So we feel the fact that the record shows that both Mr. Rupi and his pastor repeatedly complained to the police about the attacks upon him, but they did nothing about it, is in our view and under the precedence of the board at least, evidence that this is a group which the Ukrainian government cannot or will not control. So therefore, it appears to us that the only real question here is, well, first of all, whether or not Mr. Rupi had in fact suffered past persecution, and if so, if there's been a change of circumstances in the Ukraine. I don't think that there can be any doubt under this court's precedence that Mr. Rupi's savage beatings were in fact persecution, and what's more, the death threat to him was persecution. For example, in the case of Vanduva, there's a case called Vanduva versus Ashcroft, I believe, in which it's cited in our brief, in which the person basically was punched in the face and suffered a broken finger, and the Seventh Circuit found that in Romania, and the Seventh Circuit found that sufficient evidence to show that he had suffered past persecution. Also, there's the case of Cantoni. Of course, it's cited in our brief. In Cantoni, it was a woman from Togo who was threatened with death, and the Seventh Circuit made quite a point of saying that a death threat, which causes a person to give up his social and relationships and to flee the country, is persecution. And that's exactly Mr. Rupi's case. He was threatened. He received a credible death threat, and as a consequence, he left the Ukraine, left his family, left the people that he associated with there, and fled to the United States. So I don't think that there's any doubt, really, that Mr. Rupi did in fact suffer past persecution. And of course, once past persecution is established, then it becomes there becomes a presumption that he has a well-founded fear of being persecuted when he returns to the Ukraine, and the burden of is upon the government to refute that. Now, the refutation which they offer is that there's been a change of circumstances in the Ukraine such that he no longer fears persecution. But look carefully at what the board said in that case. The board said that there has been a change of circumstances since independence such that Mr. Rupi no longer fears persecution. Independence occurred in the Ukraine in 1991. Mr. Rupi suffered his persecution in 1996 and in 2000. There's also actually an incident in 1998 as well, but it's questionable whether that incident itself rose to the level of persecution.
Just a kind of a factual thing. Do these encounters, are these in the process of his doing whatever he's doing to convert and prophesize and that sort of thing? Is this an aggressive act on his part, or I'm trying to envision what causes these encounters?
Generally speaking, it was in the course of him proselytizing. He was spreading the good news, and there were people obviously who did not want to hear it. Now there was an assault in the March. It's not absolutely clear that that was the facts of the 2000 assault. The facts of the 2000 assault were not not apparently directly related to proselytization. He merely the evidence shows that he was surrounded by some people in the marketplace who assaulted him. But they didn't assault him randomly. He testified that the people who generally were attacking him, and these were actually testified to 12 to 13 attacks over a period of a number of years, and that generally speaking, the people who were attacking him were these Ukrainian nationalists. They're actually members of this group called UNAUSO, and they're quite well identified. I mean, they had little eagles, they had black shirts. They were about as well identified as a Nazi would be with the swastika. So he knew perfectly well who these people were and what their complaint was with him. They wanted him to shut his mouth and not go around telling people about his religion.
Counsel, how do you deal with the government's critique, on page 23 of its brief, that different groups seem to be alleged as these attackers? One time, okay. An organization called OUN.
Your Honor, that's a very good point, and the government has, I'm sorry to say, completely taken his statements out of context. Mr. Rupi wrote an affidavit in support of his asylum application in which he talked in historical terms about the activities of Ukrainian nationalists since World War II, and he said these are the Ukrainian groups that have been active in the period after World War II. After World War II, they went around doing horrible things to the Baptists. And then the very next paragraph, that's paragraph 4, the very next paragraph he says, my parents told me about all the awful things these people did to them. He was talking there about the groups which persecuted his parents. He wasn't talking about the groups that persecuted him. That was kind of historical background.
So your view is that the government is misleading us in this paragraph?
I would say the government misunderstood Mr. Rupi's affidavit. Absolutely. I think that yellow light means my time's up.
Have some rebuttal time.
Okay. Thank you.
Ms. Hong.
Thank you, and may it please the Court, Catherine Hahn on behalf of the United States. I can certainly address why on this record the board's finding is correct, and certainly no other conclusion is compelled as to why there was no past persecution. But I think the court was correct to focus on that the key element that was missing for past persecution to be found here was a government connection. There simply is no requisite government connection, as this court made clear in a case that cited in the briefs, Hor, H-O-R. The government there in Algeria basically told the petitioner in that case, you have to protect yourself. And this circuit recognized in Hor that it was of that level that it would be required to find that the government condoned the persecution.
Counsel here said that there were numerous complaints made and that the government did nothing. Are you telling us as a matter of law that's insufficient?
Yes, I believe there were two incidents here that were reported to the police, and the fact that the petitioner himself made a second report, the government would submit, is proof that the petitioner knew they wouldn't do nothing. The fact that they were not solved is simply not the standard. And yes, I am telling you, Your Honor, that as a matter of law, under this court's precedence in Hor, and also a case that's cited in our brief, Lopez, this petitioner's speculative assertions, and if you look at his brief at page 5 and at page 22, he says for the most part it was nationalists who attacked him. He can't even identify that it was nationalists who attacked him each time. That's on page 5 and on page 22 of his brief, where he says for the most part it was nationalists. And then if you want to see how speculative his claim is, if you look in the record at AR page 202, he talks about how every police station has nationals, and that's why they weren't doing anything about his complaint. He offers nothing other than this speculative assertion that because there were nationalists in the police station, there was nothing that was being done about his complaint. But that's simply not enough, and it certainly does not meet the standard of compelling reversal here. Now, even if there were a government connection here, which we submit there is not, under precedents like the Hoare case and the Lopez case, I could also talk about why
Before we get there, you said he couldn't identify the groups precisely. What is your reply to counsel's view of this paragraph in your brief on page 23?
I mean, the government's position here is that he has never alleged one particular group of nationalists has attacked him. In fact, if you look at page, I think it's on page 19 of his brief in footnote 9. Again, reveals the kind of speculativeness I'm talking about here. And that footnote reads, since almost all of the many other incidents which Mr. Rupi testified to involved assaults upon him by anti-Baptist Ukrainian nationalists, it is reasonable to infer that the person who invaded his home, and I believe that was the 2000 incident that counsel referenced, and left a threatening message, was a Ukrainian nationalist. So I don't even think the petitioner himself has made the assertion that it was always Ukrainian nationalists. Again, on page 5 of his brief, and again on page 22, he says that most of the time it was Ukrainian nationalists. And even then, the government would submit that Ukrainian nationalist does not equate the Ukrainian government being unwilling or unable to condone. If you look at this court's case in Hor, it makes it pretty clear that something more is required. In that case, in that Hor case, you had a judicial declaration saying the government is unable to protect you. And Judge Posner wrote for this court, I believe he said that it would take something of that level.
But the testimony at trial, am I correct, was that all of them were by this, he testified at trial, that all of them were by this group, UNAUSO. Is that right?
Well, he did testify to that, but he also, in some of his written submissions, makes other submissions. Correct, Your Honor. And even if this court were to disagree and find that the record here compels reversal, even if that were to be made, that finding were to be made, the government submits that it has rebutted any presumption, such that petitioner does not have a well-founded fear. And I find it instructive that opposing counsel noted the Viduva case, and I think the Viduva case actually helps the United States government here, because if you look at that case, and Judge Mannion wrote for the court, there that conditions in the country don't change overnight. In fact, in Vidova, the beating that was alleged to have occurred in that case happened after the fall of a dictator, several years after the fall of a dictator. Nonetheless, this court held that country conditions don't change overnight. Of course, the Department of State report is not the end-all and be-all, but absent the petitioner coming back and rebutting that with something else, that simply won't be good enough, and that's exactly what we have here. The petitioner is saying that the Department of State reports aren't convincing enough, yet offering nothing to show that it is, that it has not changed. In fact, in the petitioner's brief at page 5, he even notes himself how his church is finally able to register after independence, whereas for 20 years before that, it was not able to register.
What is in the record in terms of the background contextual evidence in the country reports or otherwise about the Ukrainian nationalist groups and their motivations for practicing religious persecution?
There's nothing in the record, Your Honor, that the government's aware of. However, there are plenty of things in the record, for example, in the record at page 234 in the 2000 Rapport report about the growing communities of Baptists and how they're really flourishing and how they're becoming the largest Protestant group. That's in the record at page 235. Also in the record on that score at administrative record citation 296 is that the government generally permits religion and worship, and that's increasing. And finally, in the record at page 330, the 2004 International Freedom Report talks about, in particular, how Protestant churches are growing. And again, this is something that the petitioner's own brief recognizes. In fact, in cross-examination, he was asked about these reports, and he acknowledged that the numbers were increasing. And as I've discussed, he acknowledged that his own church was able to be registered. So the petitioner, quite simply, has offered nothing to rebut these State Department reports, so that even assuming there was past persecution, he's done nothing to rebut the presumption.
Is there a history of anti-Semitism among these groups?
Among these groups, yes, but that's not at issue in this case, and that's why the citation that petitioner's counsel referred to in the 28J letter he filed yesterday, that case I don't think helps at all because, number one, those are different facts. It's an anti-Semitic targeting. There are different facts, and we don't even know the evidence in that particular case that that petitioner adduced to convince the BIA that there was a sufficient connection. We simply don't have that here. And again, the government submits that even if we had that, such that past persecution was met, we don't have anything that's rebutted what we have put into evidence in terms of the State Department questions. So if this court has no further questions.
I could have one if I may, perhaps. May know the answer. In his opinion, the immigration judge, quoting the United States State Department report, this is on page 134 of the appendix, the last couple of lines, he says, "Evangelical Baptists are perhaps the largest group, claiming over 140,000 members and approximately 160,000 communities." Mm. More communities than members?
Yeah. That might be a typographical error, Your Honor.
There's something wrong there, yeah.
Although I see that he is quoting from the report, and I think that report you can find in the record at page 234. So we could check the record to see if it's a misquote. The bottom line here, though, of course, is that Protestant and, in particular, Baptists are being allowed to flourish, certainly more so than before the fall of communism, and as this court's case recognizes in Vidova. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Piston, how much time? You've got 1 minute left.
Vidova is very good for us because this case is the anti-Vidova. In Vidova, the persecution occurred to Mr. Vidova in 1992. Communism fell in 1989. And the Seventh Circuit specifically found that the situation was still in a transition, that the evidence showed that there was still a transitional period. The State Department said over the past 6 years, things have improved, 6 years since independence. So what the Department of State said, between 1989 and 1995, situation improved in Romania, so therefore the fact there was a presumption, it could be concluded that there was an improvement in the situation since Mr. Vaduva was persecuted in 1992. Here the Board of Immigration Appeals said the situation has improved since independence in 1991. Mr. Rupi was persecuted in 1996 and 2000. Now, once a past persecution has been established, and I think it clearly has been, the burden is upon the government to prove that there's been an improvement in the change of situations. All the government did is say, well, there's lots of Baptists now, and they can register in 2002. They didn't make any showing what the situation was in 1996 or 2000, so they didn't make a showing that the situation had improved since 1996 and 2000.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.